Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
This podcast is an opportunity for our two studios to come together each week and provide insight into the creative industry from our unique point of view as the bridge between clients and creatives. Using the internet as our lens, we hope the conversations here will be of value to anyone whose job it is to bring creative things to life. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using the Pocket Cast or Overcast podcatchers, you can directly link to the articles discussed here as well as get enhanced visual content as we move along. Season 3. Oh my God. We made it.
We did.
This season, we're shaking things up a bit. We heard you, and we know you love the open tab segments. So this season, we're focusing on that. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to be speaking to some of our favorite people in the industry. In fact, each week, we'll bring someone new on to contribute their own link and thoughts to the discussion. But before we get started and introduce our guest this week, how is everyone going? Lara, how are you?
I'm okay. My housemate brought her family dog to stay with us. And it's like this geriatric border collie who's very sweet, but she barked the entire night. And then at like 6 a.m. I just got up and came to work because I couldn't handle it anymore. But then I texted my boyfriend to complain about it. And he was like, I can beat that. And I was like, what? He left the dog inside when he went.
Just beat the dog.
No, not the dog. Oh, Jesus Christ. Jeremy, your brain is dark. No, he left the dog inside when he went to open the gym this morning and she shat all over his bed. He bought a new jacket on the weekend. Like the doona, the mattress, everything has to go. Like it's got to be thrown out. And it's just like, and the bad thing was that I was mostly annoyed that I couldn't complain because mine was nowhere near as bad.
Welcome. Bianca, how are you?
Man, I had to dust off the vocal cords. It has been so long. But can we just talk about, Jeremy, how are you? What has been going on in your life?
We are returning from a bit of an unplanned, unexpected hiatus. We took our season break after season 2 and we're supposed to be back around maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. But yes, I had an unforeseen accident where I broke my collarbone into 4 to 5 pieces, which then required it to be put back together with a plate and screws and a cast. And it's been quite a disruption, to say the least. So, yes.
I've seen the scar and it's sick.
I cannot look at the scar. I had staples there because it's over a tattoo as well. Apparently, they have to, it's a bit of an art to realign the tattoo to get it right. But it's good.
I was going to ask whether they actually made an effort to do that. That's interesting.
It's, all those butterflies over there and the symbol as well.
Live, love, love. Yeah.
And it still looks so peaceful.
But yes, thank you for asking, B. I feel on top of it. So glad to be back. And I'm so glad to be welcoming our first guest for season 3. Today, we have the effervescent Gemma O'Brien joining us all the way from Sydney, also known by her Instagram handle, MrsZeeves101. Gemma is a Sydney-based lettering artist, designer, and pretty much international speaker at this stage. Gemma, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. And I didn't know when I was allowed to laugh at all the jokes in the first section, so I'm glad that I've finally been welcomed and can freely laugh at everyone's jokes.
Oh, don't worry. We'll be getting plenty of your chuckles to just kind of pepper in.
We love that chuckle.
In post. Yeah, absolutely. Where have you returned from? What have you been up to?
I have just been on a month-long, I would say, world tour because I started in America, New York, went to Oslo, Portugal, London, and then back to America to paint a mural at Google in Mountain View. And so, yeah, it's been quite the epic journey.
It's basically what I've just done this week.
Well, Jem, I'm really looking forward to getting into our links this week. Let's kick it off with Bianca. Bianca, what have you got for us today in your open tabs?
Well, speaking of Google, my link is from wired.com and it is titled The Research Behind Google's New Tools for Digital Wellbeing. And last week, I think at like their kind of developers conference, Google announced several new features which are designed to help people monitor and manage the time that they spend on their devices. The goal being to essentially enable users to understand their habits, control the demands technology places on their attention, and focus on what matters. And it is so exciting to me to see a tech company like Google actually acknowledging some of the scientific and sometimes anecdotal research into how smartphone use is affecting our attention and mental health and building tools and features into their devices, like actually baking them into their devices that shift the focus on to digital well-being. And I speak about this a little bit. And Lara, over the past few months, I mean, you and I have experimented with the iPhone app Moment to help kind of track and monitor how much time we have been spending on our phones each day. And I'm not sure if you're still kind of looking at your statistics, but it has been a few months since we brought it up on the podcast. And I wanted to really quickly check in again. I mean, has it taught you anything, and have your habits changed over that time, or is there anything that you found particularly helpful?
Look, I mean, I know that this is something that you are like super, super positive about, B, but I have to say I'm a little bit skeptical. Like, I just don't know that there's any going back to the days before like notifications and excessive phone scrolling ruined our lives. Like, I think we're sort of addicts and we're not going to be able to control this behavior as long as we have access to these devices. Like, I kind of think of it, you know, like it's like a drug addict having like bags of crack in their pockets. Like, you'd have a bloody hard time resisting it. And like, that's what it's like for me. Like, I tried Moment and I just found that like, Moment sent me so many notifications and like it was driving me crazy, and it was so annoying that I just deleted the app. And like, I think as well, like just knowing the information didn't really encourage change for me. So I think perhaps some of the other features that Google introducing, like Shush, and which is one where like you flip over you put your phone face down and it sort of puts it on like Do Not Disturb, and Wind Down where it sort of puts it on Do Not Disturb before your bedtime or whatever, they might help a bit more because they're actually sort of like active things. But I don't know. We've talked about this before, and I have to say, like, I don't have a problem with how much I use my phone. And like, that's not to say that like, I don't use an excessive amount. Like, I have a problem. I don't have a problem with that, I guess. Like, yeah, like I don't feel bad about it, and I don't feel like it causes me stress or really like affects other aspects of my life. That said, I don't think my usage is anywhere near yours, B.
I mean, okay, yes. Like, I think for me, one of the most illuminating discoveries was just actually how much time I spend specifically on Instagram. It is my most used app, and I've like, over the past kind of couple of months, like, awareness has definitely changed how I've used it, and it's changed my scrolling habits, and I think I've unfollowed about 350 people just to kind of try and cut back. But I think I'm still...
That's good. Not us, hopefully.
Not you.
Our content's too good.
Honestly, a lot of work-related things, which I'll get to in a minute. But I'm still clocking like an average of like an hour a day on Instagram, which I guess I don't watch television. So it's kind of not too bad because maybe I'm like replacing it with television. But it's just like I have this like overwhelming like feeling that it's really not the best use of my time. And it is so passive and so like easy to just mindlessly sit there and scroll. And I think a lot of it
can be mindless sometimes though, like if you're keeping it under
control. But what I'm finding really challenging is, I think especially since moving to New York, which is so intense and so stimulating already, and you know, I think my attention is pulled in a million different directions. You know, my work is very fragmented as well, especially being in an administrative position. I do find that I feel like it's changed my brain. Like, and I find it increasingly difficult to really commit to periods of focused attention. And I think my life is different here. Like, I'm not doing things, like I'm not performing in theater, which I used to find back in Melbourne was a really like nice way for me to kind of be mindful. And it was very meditative to be in the performing, in the rehearsal space. So I honestly think like it's changed my brain a bit. The content as well, I'm like,
so you'll have to join Broadway.
I will. I mean, yeah, bye. But I mean, I think the content as well, like, you know, what I'm looking at, what I'm wanting to post, it's like so, it's just becoming so increasingly homogenized and boring, like for the platform. And I'm just like,
I totally agree. Like, to me, that's what's helped me cut back on it is the fact that like most social media is just really, really boring. Like, I just don't care. I just don't care about it anymore. Like, I was trying to think carefully about like, what do I use my phone most for? And like, I think it's sort of like five things really. It's like podcasts, which like I don't find that a waste of time at all. Sometimes like posting my own Insta stories, but I don't really look at anyone else's, which probably says something bad about my personality, but whatever. Like Googling weird things, which I think is fine as well. I use Messenger a lot to chat to friends and family, but I think that's fine. And then there's just like two iPhone games that give me life and sanity, and I'm never giving them up. It's fine. It goes back and forward at the moment. I've gotten over balls. I just like couldn't beat my high score and I got over it. True Dots and Homescapes, which is the one where you're a butler and you live with your parents and you're trying to redo their house. It's very good.
I know I've brought this topic up on the podcast a number of times, but I wanted to bring it up again. Yes, because I'm thinking of doing something crazy. I'm actually thinking of deleting Instagram and Twitter. But here, like, oh, that's where
do you
that's
deleting, or do you well, mean this is, this your is, account?
Gemma, this is like my dilemma because, like, you know, we work in advertising. We work in this like really fast and very trend-based industry, which is like in this constant state of flux and innovation. And I feel like sometimes I'm in a bit of a trap, like keeping up to date with what's happening on social media, like kind of makes up a pretty big part of my role. And so the idea of actually cutting back or like completely cutting it out of my life is like super challenging. And especially I think, Gemma, for someone like yourself who, you know, your Instagram, like you have a very impressive following and your feed is a really key part of, you know, it's basically your folio and it's a way that you attract a lot of clients and commercial clients that commission you to do work. So I'd be curious to hear how you separate the two.
Yeah, well, I mean, I definitely, you know, I feel what you guys are talking about. And, you know, I often delete Instagram if I'm like really busy or just to slow down that automatic pilot of like looking at your phone, clicking on it and getting into like a scroll fest. But, you know, then I reinstall it and it's, you know, back to normal. But I think that for me, what I started to realize is when my Instagram shifted from just being like, you know, a social tool, maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, taking pictures of food and what I was doing. And then I started to use it more of like either a space to experiment with different approaches or like share, you know, process images in pieces that I was working on. It definitely became a tool in attracting work. And now I definitely, like, it's purely professional. Like there are some elements that I'll include, obviously posting like travels and things that are inspiring me, but yeah, I don't know. It's, I have a love-hate relationship with Instagram and with social media in general. And I think for me, one of the main things that helped with like reducing the amount of time was realizing, especially if you're creating content, like as an artist or a designer, not everything you post on your Instagram has to be new and created that day. And that sometimes it can help give you time if you're like, you know, if you've done one project, if I've done a mural and there's like 4 different images, and then I might post those over the next 6 months because people don't, I mean, I'm sure there's probably a couple of people that are like, oh, that's not you. But I think it's more about...
Those people suck.
It's me. Gemma, where's the new content? You're the reason
exactly.
I want to quit.
But I think it's more about like, if I think about how I get inspired by people, I don't mind if I'm seeing an artist post something. I'm like, that's right. That was cool. I remember that. Or just like having an ongoing presence to remind art directors and remind people who might be booking jobs. Like, here I am. Don't forget about me. but yeah, I mean, I think in the future that like luxury will be disconnection and that people will seek that out in various ways.
I think we could do a whole podcast series on this, honestly. I mean, it's such a ripe
topic. Sure there's already 20 podcast series on this.
Ironically, because you would have to like be completely plugged in to listen to
exactly.
But I think this is something that we come back to because I think it's such a big part of what it means to kind of be creative and how kind of ideas form. And I think, you know, really people need kind of mental space to allow kind of other things to kind of come in and allow connections to get made. And I think one of the real troubling things about all these kind of tools is that it's about getting that hit of dopamine quicker and quicker and quicker. That's like that's the difference of kind of scrolling through the feed. And there's kind of this, I guess, if you look kind of historically through the past 100 years, you know, there's always kind of a bit of a moral panic about whatever the technology is at the moment, whether it's like, I think people, you know, reacted very similar to kind of the printing press of like, you know, oh, that people are going to have these books and newspapers on them. It's going to destroy the moral fabric of society. And then it moved on to kind of TV as well.
I mean,
well.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, you can actually make that argument in some ways and then have it move to kind of TV in a way. And now it's like, you know, people are double screening because they can't even develop the attention that it takes just to watch a TV show. You know, it's like you're so distracted. I noticed it myself, you know, when I was stuck at home, you know, it's like I couldn't even go to the bathroom without my phone in my hand. You know, it's like, and sometimes you just have to kind of, it's like you're just kind of looking at it to kind of fill that time. And I think it kind of, it really kind of will have and is having, you know, these negative effects in lots of ways, especially for kind of creatives. I guess the thing that's interesting for this article as well is what motivation do the companies have to actually make these tools that are going to be there to kind of change that when their whole business model is making you look at the ad and making you look at the thing?
Well, I guess that now people are so aware of this and are so like, I guess, because it has, this problem has become a focus. Like, as we just said, you know, they're joking, like there's probably 20 series on this, but yeah, it's true. People are really, really concerned about these things. And so they're starting to let that play into their purchasing decisions. So it's like not a good thing for certain businesses, but for the people who manufacture the actual handset, there is absolutely financial motivation here. For the people who manufacture all the other stuff, I don't know.
You know, I read a lot about this all the time. And just like you were saying, you know, you're using Moment and like that's actually fracturing your attention even more with all of their pop-ups. So it's like, I feel, okay, it's good that people are thinking about this and trying to develop some tools kind of around it. But I don't know. I'm still a bit dark on the whole thing.
The part that just stuck out for me was right at the end when they say, overall, the steps Google is taking are great, but I would really like to see some rigorous investigations that indicate people like the features, use them, and feel empowered by them, Przybylski says. I can't remember who Przybylski is because I've just pulled out this quote. Says like an empirical study or three. That means open and robust research, registered, randomized, controlled trials, independent replications. It would be good for science and it would be good for the product.
And if I don't reply to your Instagram DM, Jeremy, you know it's because I believe
We'll talk about that offline. Next up is me. I am actually linking to quite an older piece, which is a blog post from a company called Trinity P3. And if anyone's listening to this in the Australian advertising scene, I think that name might ring a bell and is somewhat kind of controversial. And I think the way that this kind of the way that I got to this post was really kind of, I guess, kind of going through different links from this article that appeared in Campaign Brief only a few days ago and is now mysteriously offline on Campaign Brief, which I'd be really curious to kind of know why. We are going to post a link to a cached version of this that has kind of some of the comments and original excerpt from the blog. And now this original article that appeared a few weeks ago was, it goes, crews that subcontract to the production companies are the real victims in the lack of transparency in advertising production. And I think there's an illustration that kind of sums up this article of four fish. One, the big fish, which is the advertiser, which is
big angry fish,
big angry red fish, which is about to eat another smaller fish, the agency. And then that fish is about to eat a smaller purple fish, the production company. And then that fish is going to eat an even smaller green fish called the crew. And this is, you know, this is an article written by Darren Woolley. He's the founder of Trinity P3, kind of going into this and then just getting savaged in the comments, basically, all about, you know, basically how... that this is a desperation play or something. I don't know. I'm not really kind of sure what this kind of feedback is about.
Well, but everyone was mad that, from the comments that I saw anyway, that like people felt that Trinity were trying to sort of rile up more distrust between client and agency so that they can get more sort of direct business themselves.
So I guess we should preface this by explaining that Trinity P3 are a, if you go to their website, they do a million different things, but I think they're most known for being a procurement agency, basically working with marketers to drive their costs down on what they spend on marketing or advertising. And I think a lot of agencies feel that because of the work they do, you know, their budgets, that they're kind of the reason why budgets are getting kind of smaller and their businesses are suffering. I mean, there's so much kind of, you know, tied into this. And I guess the reason I kind of wanted to bring this up is because through reading this article and then kind of linking to other things, I kind of opened up a bit of a, what I kind of feel is a bit of a treasure trove of articles that they've been writing on their own website since, I mean, for years now. I mean, they've been in business for, I think, nearly a decade. And the article that I'm kind of mainly linking to is something from 2013, which is titled, Marketers Should Set Production Budgets or Pay the Consequences. And for all the kind of flack that was given on this Campaign Brief article, they also posted on Umbrella at the same time and has some comments there which aren't as vicious. But for all the kind of flack there, I found that this was a really insightful piece that I actually felt was really, I guess, friendly towards all kind of people involved. And it was kind of not kind of putting a warning out to marketers, but kind of really explaining that if you don't kind of come to the table with a creative project with a budget, you're not going to kind of get the results that you need, and everyone's going to kind of be scrambling and no one's going to kind of be happy in that. And I kind of really feel that this is kind of some very even-handed writing that looks after, okay, not only the agencies, not only the marketers, but the crew and the production companies that the agencies kind of rely on as well. And I think for someone like us at Jackie Winter, I feel like we're in kind of very similar kind of positions. So this kind of really resonated with me, and this set me down a rabbit hole of, I guess, a whole day reading all these kind of a lot of different posts there. I mean, I'm, you know, really kind of fascinated by their business in kind of some ways. I definitely kind of see the critique over there, but I think talking just about this piece, I found it really insightful in terms of trying to put some clear language over why setting a budget is really important, and but also more importantly, how production fees are actually kind of set and how they've historically been set, which is looking at how much money an advertiser is going to spend actually kind of pushing their message. So, you know, if they're buying airtime or if they're buying billboards, and then tip and historically what percentage of that should be spent on the actual kind of production of those things. So I felt that was kind of insightful, and actually writing an article that actually has kind of numbers in it as well.
What I don't understand.
Yes.
And maybe like I struggled with this piece a little bit, but like what I don't understand is, how does a client coming to the table with a budget stop an agency from screwing over the production company and stop the production company from screwing over the crew? Like, how does that provide transparency beyond just what the agency knows? You know, like, sure, the agency then has some transparency in terms of what their client want to work with, but they still want to retain as much of it as possible for themselves. So they still sort of screw the you know, the production crew, and then the production crew also want to retain as much of it for themselves, and they didn't screw the crew, you know? So it's like, I don't really know how that transparency goes beyond and anywhere beyond that first level.
I think that's an interesting question. That's a bigger question, more about kind of, I guess, yeah, human nature and greed and kind of business practices as well. But I kind of think that what I've kind of noticed as well, and again, this article is from 2013, so a lot has changed in the last kind of 5 years. And I think one of the biggest things that's happening is how business is kind of being pitched as well, with everyone kind of playing the cards so close to their chest. And this fact of like, okay, well, everyone kind of wants to do the best job and wants to do the most impressive thing. But if they don't understand, like one of the things that we try to talk about upfront, especially when we're talking about animation, and I think Dom put this really well when we had him on the show, when we were talking about how do you take an animation brief. And I think one of the first things we try to look at is like, say like, okay, well, what is the ambition of this project? And a lot of the times that is kind of often tied to how many people do we want to kind of see this? And then a lot of that time it's tied to like, well, how much money are we going to invest in the media? And I think a lot of these questions are kind of really kind of basic and haven't really kind of changed, but always the ambition of the project is kind of tied to how much money they kind of want to spend. And I feel that.
So you do like the idea that production costs are sort of set as a percentage of a media buy. You think that works?
I think it does make sense. I can't think of any other alternative. Like, can you?
No. Like, I'm genuinely just asking. I'm not challenging. Like, I really don't know. It's like, it's a hard thing to, you need some sort of guide, some sort of parameter. And what they provide here is like, when I first read through the article, they provide this sort of relatively simple guide for setting a production budget. And I thought, great, that's great. That's a really great guideline. So then I was sort of like, why? But then I couldn't sort of really think, why not? And then my brain exploded and I just decided to come in here and ask you instead.
I just think overall, like, you know, what Trinity wants and what they were kind of talking about in this kind of first article is more transparency with cost. And I think that's kind of something that I'm really trying to integrate as well in terms of the tools that we're building and trying to
that
make
I
that
agree
kind
with
of
wholeheartedly.
More transparent.
That's the problem. We work in an industry where it's like knowledge and man hours rather than like physical things that like have a hard cost. So it's like it is possible to negotiate because
everything has like there's still
I'm not
a
saying
lot
people
of
should
of,
but it just like people do, and I think people know that, and that's always going to be the case.
B, what do you think?
I think the article that you're directly referencing now about transparency and production costs, like, I totally agree with, like, and I think part of the article they kind of talk about sometimes you do need to take the risk and invest in a great but expensive idea, and that can be worth it. But, you know, like, most of the time, be realistic, be transparent, and build, you know, a fair budget around what you actually are looking to spend and where you're looking to spend it. I think the interesting thing for me is the question of does stacking the production costs as a percentage of the media buy actually hold up now, because we have such, you know, it's difficult. I feel like the landscape has changed a lot. And, you know, I was talking about this the other day when I was explaining usage fees and licensing fees and how to cost them and where they come from to someone. And it's difficult now because media is so fragmented. And how do you put a dollar value on something like social media, which, you know, is different to a billboard or a television commercial, and the media costs are different and they're calculated differently. Like, I don't know. Like, can it be calculated in the same way right now? I have no clue.
This is another kind of related blog called The Ad Contrarian. And it said, this latest post from this week is, you know, what do clients want? It's a tweet and says, what is it that clients want these days exactly? I find it increasingly hard to tell. As soon as I, and I'm quoting here from the article, as soon as I saw this, I started to type without thinking. I wrote, they want the fruits of advertising without the cost of advertising. It was one of those instances where something writes itself without me. And I think, yeah, like that's exactly kind of what's happening with this fragmentation as well. It's like, you know, so clients want kind of, you know, this really kind of wide reach, or they want this kind of hyper-focused reach. But they don't want to pay for it, or they don't want to kind of pay for it in the same way. And I think it does make a big challenge for production companies, especially when clients want to engage, you know, multiple production companies make multiple pieces of work and they all want to be kind of strong and be in a million different platforms. I do think it's a part of a bigger conversation about, I don't think it's about kind of driving costs down and pressuring, you know, putting pressure on the production companies, because in the end, it's just kind of getting bad work that's just not going to work. I think that this is just kind of a bottom line conversation about like, how to have a conversation around making things. And I think it has to, I think it really does need to kind of start with the budget. I think that's the best way to make work. There needs to be some kind of guidance there. And if anyone has anything else to share or kind of add to, you know, please give us an email at podcast@jackiewinter.com and we can chat about it more. Next up, Laura, go fast and break things.
I will.
Tell us about your link from this week.
Yeah, this is a piece from the Fantastic Farnham Street blog, as you said, called Go Fast and Break Things, the difference between reversible and irreversible decisions. So the whole idea here is that some decisions are irreversible, while others are indeed reversible. And, you know, that the time you spend making each decision should be directly related to, you know, which of those categories it sits in. And so it all sort of stems from this letter that Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, penned to his shareholders, where he outlines this concept of reversible and irreversible decisions. So he writes, some decisions are consequential and irreversible, or nearly irreversible, one-way doors, and these decisions must be made methodically, carefully, slowly, with great deliberation and consultation. If you walk through and don't like what you see on the other side, you can't get back to where you were before. We call these type one decisions. But most decisions aren't like that. They're changeable, reversible, they're two-way doors. If you've made a suboptimal type two decision, you don't have to live with the consequences for that long. You can reopen the door and go back through. Type two decisions can and should be made quickly by high judgment individuals or small groups. As organizations get larger, there seems to be a tendency to use the heavyweight type one decision making process on most decisions, including many type two decisions. The end result of this is slowness, unthoughtful risk aversion, failure to experiment sufficiently, and consequently diminished invention. And I think this is really true. This article spoke really loudly to me for multiple reasons. One is that I dread the idea of working within an organization that is so monolithic that nothing ever changes or adapts for the better. And I mean, it's definitely one of the key reasons that I love working for and with you, Jeremy, because, you know, the speed with which something that can go from sort of random great idea to actual realized thing is wonderful. But at the same time, I am very much someone who feels like they need to know every single piece of possible information before making a decision about anything. And I know you guys see that in action all the time. I have this sort of like intense anxiety over making the wrong decision or not getting the most value out of a decision. And that can be really useful when I'm put in a role of making sort of delicate, complex assessments, or doing sort of like proofreading, like I do a lot of the time. But I do sometimes sort of find it a bit hard to move quickly, which is why I do find it really, really important to surround myself with people who do think like this, because then, you know, we provide each other's necessary balances. I was thinking about it, like even things like ordering brunch, like I genuinely struggle to make a quick choice. Like I'm always like silently weighing up the pros and cons in my head and sort of like debating which meal would give me the most satisfying experience versus cost versus nutritional breakdown versus how long it will be before I eat there again. And like, it's totally nuts. So I find this kind of thinking really helpful. And I've always been totally like bamboozled by people who naturally think and act like this. I think Jeremy, you're one of these people, and Dan, my partner, is one of them as well. And especially this sentiment that they say in the article of, A good plan violently executed now is better than a perfect plan next week.
What does violently executed mean? I find that to be a really...
It is a bit jarring. It's dramatic. A bit, but you know, that's just the quote, all right? And like, I just find it so incredibly hard to live that way. Like, I often want to make sure that I'm doing something in the best possible way before I spend any time doing it. So like, it is something that I have to actually like consciously practice. Like, because it's definitely not always worth the time and energy to gather more information and look for these sort of flawless answers, even though, like, as they say in the article, like the research might make the decision or action like 5% better. You might lose so much time or resource by doing that research that it's just not worth it. And making quick decisions can certainly provide a very like competitive advantage. And then, of course, though, if a decision is irreversible, it is really important to be able to recognize that and to slow down that decision-making process and ensure that you're considering all of the information and understanding the problem as thoroughly as is needed. And anyway, again, my head started exploding. And I just want to know, like, how do you guys personally deal with stuff like this? Like, does this way of thinking come naturally to you?
The fact that this article exists, like, is an illustration that it, like, I just don't even get it, you know? It's like,
what?
I don't know. It's just like, it's like, I mean, yeah, I understand, like, why you should kind of think about things, but I don't know. Anyway, I mean, I just kind of, it's interesting as well, because, like, of, I guess what we do as producers is, like, we need to balance that out with, I guess if you look at the artistic or creative process as something that is supposed to be kind of generated in some kind of flow state that's a bit more kind of unrestrained, but, you know, still kind of applying to kind of a commercial brief, then I think your perspective is something that we would kind of seek out as a producer in terms of someone who can kind of rein that in and take that through a methodical process to kind of go back to a brief. So there are some beneficial reasons to kind of want to develop those qualities, but at the same time, you don't want it to be so much that it kind of hamstrings the process where things are getting caught because they're being kind of thought over kind of too much.
Well, I want to bring it back to Gemma because, I mean, Gem, we've been working together for, I think, 6 years. And I remember like early on in your freelance career and working with you on some of, you know, your first larger scale commercial projects. One thing that I always admired was your fearlessness. I mean, that's just something that I think is one of the most wonderful things about you. And if I think about my own career as well, like some of the, I mean, everything that I've done that's been worthwhile and has always involved some kind of like uncomfortable leap of faith. And if I bring kind of this article back to production, you know, I do think that you're never, I think Jeremy, as you were saying, you're never going to have all of the information, but you need to trust that you have enough to just get started. And otherwise, you know, you might miss out on an opportunity or you might, hold yourself back.
Yeah, I think that the decision making, like what they mentioned in there about like how to decide which one is a fast decision, which one is something you need to think about longer, requires experience. And I think that when you're first doing it, whether it's in the creative or it's in the production, there is like this almost like naivety, which can be beneficial. And because you don't, you know, as it mentions in the article, you don't necessarily know how is this going to play out or how much time is it going to take, and you just do it. And then you like, you learn the hard way and good things come out of it and bad things come out of it. And I think that as you get more experienced in whatever your field, it can be beneficial because maybe you can make better decisions in terms of timings or knowing how long things take, but maybe you're a little bit less, you know, prone to take these bigger leaps of faith, and that you kind of have to force that back into your practice a little bit more.
So basically I'm the crazy one and you guys are all fine.
Laura, I think I mentioned when you first posted this, when we were discussing this article on Slack, I just couldn't stop thinking, like I was listening, as soon as I read this, I was listening to this episode of Hurry Slowly, which is a podcast recently where they interviewed Julie Zhao of Facebook. And I'm pretty sure the episode was recorded before the fallout of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. But so the irony of Julie proclaiming that Facebook's company motto was fail fast, fail often was definitely not lost on me.
Very interesting. Gemma, bring us home with your link of the week, something that I'm dying to hear your opinion on, which is Melania Trump's hand-on logo for her anti-bullying campaign, Be Best.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, there's many articles about this. The one that I've selected here is from Creative Block, and the title is Can Melania Trump Be Best at Logo Design? So I guess, you know, if anyone doesn't know about this already, Most of the first ladies of the USA, the presidents of the United States of America, get the opportunity to have an initiative that will be the focus for them to work on and during their time as the first lady. And, you know, in the past, Laura Bush, I think, promoted literacy. Michelle Obama did something around fitness for young people. And so Melania Trump has chosen to focus on, I guess, being best in children's, like, well-being. I think she mentioned specifically social media and then also opioid addictions. There's a few things being thrown into the mix there. But the most exciting thing about this from a graphic design point of view, of course, is the logo, which when I saw this when it first came out, you know, I was like, it was the first thing I noticed. I was shocked. I wanted to find out who designed it. And, you know, a couple of days later, I realized and I saw a few articles coming out that said that she, in fact, designed it herself, which was just even more great. And it's really hard to, I think, look at this logo and the whole concept without laughing and without feeling like you couldn't even fake something this bad, you know. But on the other side, I feel like I want to, you know, not be judgmental, because the whole point of the whole campaign itself is about, you know, I guess, encouraging and promoting, you know, I guess, positivity and good practice in social media and giving you a good example.
But even the name, like, be best, it's not like everyone be a better version of themselves. It's be the best, like, beat everyone else, be the best one there is at everything. Like, that in itself is so, like, I don't know, it just seems to negate the whole cause. It's so bizarre.
It's just confounding. And I think Jem, did you read at all? Do you read Under Consideration at all, Brand
New? Yes, I did see the Under Consideration article about it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of thoughts over there as well. I think there's always a very robust comment section. But yeah, I mean, it literally looks like it was drawn just kind of with the chisel brush in Photoshop.
You know when kids are like just starting to draw and write and they sort of hold the marker with their whole fist around it, like instead of, like, you know how we hold the pen, but they sort of grip it with their fist. It looks like that's been done with a marker. They just sort of started scrolling madly. I don't understand.
I really think it was done digitally, like drawn and, like, as you said, Jeremy, like drawn directly in Photoshop. I actually tried to recreate it last night on the iPad Pro.
Can you please send that to us?
Well,
please.
Yes, I will. But one of the things in the Under Consideration article mentioned, okay, one was the positive of, if you're going to have a hand-drawn logo, that each of the letters should be different, so no two B's should be the same. And I thought this was an interesting point, because that's often, you know, someone that does a lot of hand-drawn stuff, I'll often look for that in logos and see if they duplicate letters.
All so the time.
There,
yes.
there was a kudos to that for making the letters different. But then another thing in the Under Consideration article mentioned is how did they get the thin lower stroke on the E's? And then I'm just looking at it, I'm like, well, it's very, like when I was drawing it on the iPad, if you have that kind of chisel pen, if you just literally go down and then straight across, it'll naturally create the thin stroke. So it looks bizarre. But there's something about this, you guys are going to laugh at me, that I like.
I actually don't hate it.
I don't think I like it from a design point of view, but I like this is the most authentic thing that the first lady of the United States of America could create, because she created it herself. Well, if she did, it's terrible, but it's real.
I think, but like, are we saying it's like authentic because they as an organization are terrible?
Exactly.
And therefore,
that's exactly
I don't know that that's positive.
Yeah, like, it's it serves its purpose a bit. And I like, that's what I don't care. Like, I don't kind of care that it's terrible, because it is what it is and it is for what it's for. I don't know.
I mean, you could talk, this bridges design and politics in a really interesting way, because first of all, you're getting to a whole kind of, form and function debate. Like, if it is kind of doing what it's supposed to be doing, like, first of all, like, what is the function of this logo? Like, who is it actually kind of talking to? Is the authenticity of someone who does not have a design background putting it together, like, is this kind of a positive thing? I was just kind of listening today about Trump's whole North Korea policy as well. It's like, you know, was it just kind of blundered into as well? Like, you know, like, can you get like these good results like without kind of really kind of thinking about it and putting kind of craft behind it and everything else? And I think, I don't know, part of me, you know, even though, like, yeah, Jem, I kind of do understand what you're saying and can kind of respect the fact that it is kind of maybe successful in some way, I just think the whole idea of having something out there that doesn't have craft or kind of thought behind it, that's kind of what makes me sad more than
what makes
anything.
Me really sad is that, like, when you talk about form and function, I think, like, the only function this is having is causing people to sort of mock the whole program, you know, the initiative as a whole. And of course that's not the intention of the initiative, and there are a lot of the First Lady has an enormous platform, you know, to, regardless of who she is and what she's tied to and whether or not you agree with it, she has a huge platform to do sort of social good. And the fact that this is the level of effort that's been put into it and it's basically become just this enormous joke is depressing. And I think, like, I don't know, like, honestly, the logo and ridiculous name aside, like, the biggest joke that is completely unavoidable is how we're supposed to imagine, like, Melania spearheading a campaign about physical and emotional well-being of children when her hubby is, like, siphoning billions of dollars away from children's healthcare and, like, pulling children away from immigrant families. And, you know, and he's also, like, Twitter's number one cyber bully. Like, the whole thing is a joke and the logo adds to it. And the name itself, like, I was so distracted by the grammatical hilarity of it that I didn't even notice the logo until Gemma sent this link through. Because it's like, I mean, like, from a purely grammatical sense, you know, obviously when you've got, like, a sort of superlative adjective like best and it's following an imperative verb like be, it needs to have that. It needs to have that article.
Big words there,
so it's just like, like, basic grammar. It has to have that in between, you know? And like that said, and we've talked about this 1,000 times in the podcast, I am all for breaking the rules of language when it comes to copy. You know, there are many brilliant slogans and headlines out there that would not work if they were grammatically correct. Like the example that's always used, like, imagine if the campaign was, have you got any milk? You know, like, it needs to be got milk, you know? But the point is that these are instances where breaking the rules of grammar lead you to some sort of higher point, some, like, clever joke or relatable slang, and be best means nothing and it achieves nothing except for sounding like a mistake. And the logo as well feels the same to me.
Yeah.
Jem, if you were approached with this as a brief, how do you think you would look at it?
Well, this is actually quite funny. I think I was talking to Jason, my boyfriend, about it, and I said, you know, talking about how terrible it was. And he said, well, you should redesign it. I'm like, well, I wouldn't design something for Melania Trump. I think from the point of view of, like, you know, I've got a project coming up this week and I've got other ones, I think, you know, writing these inspirational phrases. I think one of them is be bold, and, you know, having that handwritten approach can work. I definitely think in this instance, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. But I also think that whenever a new logo gets, you know, revealed, there's always criticism. Like, there's always criticism within the design community, especially. Often if it's a familiar brand, there's criticism from every, you know, the public. But in this particular instance, I think it's more about the design world looking at it rather than anyone else. Everyone else is just criticizing, as we said, either the grammar or the overall concept. So I think that's interesting in itself as well. Mm,
definitely. I was wondering as well, like, so you know how they someone made Donald Trump's handwriting into a font that you could download called Tiny Hand. Yeah. I wonder how long it'll take someone to make a font of the be best.
Yeah, I'm sure it must already be out.
Yeah, I'm sure it exists. Process. Yeah.
Oh, Jem, thank you so much for sharing your link and your opinions there. It's been very insightful. And yeah, we'd love to see that, you know, your interpretation of that.
I will send that through.
Excellent.
But I think, Gemma, to quote your keynote from a few years ago, I think what we've learned from this is just death to inspirational quotes.
Exactly. It still holds true all these years later.
For the last two seasons, we have closed with the most Melbourne and the most New York thing of the week. But I think we kind of reached the natural end of that. So
we covered them all.
We covered them all. And I think also because I got such an amazing response to my adhesive-related discussion, whinge that I had the other week, I thought, like, I think we can spin this out a bit longer because we have lots of strong opinions on things. But as producers as well, we also, you know, are problem solvers too. And we want to kind of, you know, I guess, use our powers of complaints to try to see if we can come up with better solutions. The first one being the actual name to the segment that we don't have. But we're just going to have a bit of a complaint of the week to go into. Lara, what do you have to complain about?
I had so many, but look, I want to talk about postage tracking. I ordered something from New Zealand recently, and like like I imagine most people do, as soon as I received the tracking link, I basically just like hit refresh like once a minute for every minute of every day. You know what? The updates were actually really good for the first few days. Like it showed it had first been picked up in Hastings and then it was processed at the outbound depot in Auckland and then it was in the air on its way to Australia and then it made its arrival at the warehouse in Melbourne and then nothing, like no updates for like 4 days. What the fuck? It just couldn't have been that far from me. Like it was in Melbourne. We were in the same city.
You got ghosted. But there
was
your package.
Seriously, like it was full blown silent treatment torture. Like it took 2 days for it to get from New Zealand to Melbourne and I had updates the entire way. Then it gets to Melbourne and fucking nothing for 4 days. Like why, how, someone fix it, explain it to me. Why is the postage system built to destroy me? I mean, and then it arrived and it was fine and like whatever, but still, I'm mad.
B, what about you? Do you have anything to whinge about?
Keeping to the theme of social media, if I see one more hashtag influencer post a screenshot to their story alerting me that there's a new post in their feed.
Oh, is that a thing
now? I think that is a thing and I think I'm going to throw my phone out the window. I mean, keeping in mind that this is coming off the back of the perspective of someone who is kind of on a bit of an anti-Instagram rant right now, but it's just such a waste of time. And
what don't you like about that?
Well, I just feel that I would rather see a piece of great content created specifically for the medium rather than like a diluted like little tease about.
And it just sort of seems like people are realizing that people are stopping using the feed and desperately grabbing onto a way to like drag people to the feed. And it's like, no, just accept that things are moving to stories now and build your content around that. We do it. We do it on the Jackie Winter Instagram.
What? Tell people on the story to go to the feed? Do we?
I think so.
Look, I'm kind of in two minds about this. Like one, I do think that people are not going to the feed as much. And that's really hard when Instagram is our kind of one of our main marketing sources right now. But also, I don't know, B, like I just think something that you said there like raises a bit of an alarm for me because it also kind of says that Instagram is a venue for kind of capital C content of things that need to kind of be produced specifically for Instagram. And I think that, I don't know, I think it's really tough because Instagram is kind of this blend of, okay, an actual social network of people that you want to kind of follow and then businesses and then influencers, which are this kind of totally new category. I think that's kind of when Facebook had their kind of big divide as well. It's like when they opened it up to brands, like, you know, who had pages and then that kind of, insert itself into your feed as well. So I think, I don't know, what?
Sorry, I just had this like brainwave. When you follow someone on Instagram, you should be able to like add them to a category and then you should be able to filter your feed by category. So like it could be like art, friends, dogs, whatever.
Doesn't that function already exist?
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
No.
I mean like Twitter lists.
I don't know. I don't use Twitter. But I want it on Instagram. Someone make that happen. Someone produce that.
But I think that's eventually, that seems obvious that would kind of happen soon. Fine. If you look at how other kind of platforms have gone. Anyway, long story short, B, I understand you. I hear what you're saying.
What's your complaint this week, Jeremy?
Oh my God. Okay. My complaint is to the manufacturers of extra gum. specifically to the, like, to the little flat envelope ones. Now,
do they open your handbag? That's what happens to me.
No. Okay. I need to show you this over here. This is a visual thing. If you're listening to this in the Enhanced podcast, you'll see a photograph of it. But basically, so how it works is like you have these rectangular pieces. They're in there. It kind of looks like a really long cigarette packet almost, like in some ways. Anyway, so you go through all the pieces in the middle, but the pieces at the end are literally like...
They're like glued in.
Yeah, they're glued in.
Yeah.
And you cannot... So it's like... So basically, you have all your gum and then at the end, there's four pieces left. There's two in the left and then there's two on the right.
I mean, like, you can get them out if you're like stronger than like a baby.
Yeah. I take umbrage with that statement. Second of all, yes, you can get them out, but not without pulling out the whole package.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And then all three pieces are kind of loose, and then you have a loose piece of gum, and there's nothing grosser than it's like, you know, when you empty your bag out, like like a month, a piece of gum has kind of come out.
Bits of lint
bits of lint on it. Yeah, exactly. And It is one of the biggest design flaws that I've really seen, like, lately. It's absolutely horrible. I don't understand why they do it that way. Why do they have to be kind of glued in that way? It really bothers me.
Is it a structural thing?
I mean, it must be, but it's like obviously they knew it was a problem. They're just like, you know, like, who cares?
It's like, whatever.
You know?
They just Jeremy, like, cares. I care. That's your kiss.
I care. I'm not going to let it go. I'm going to put photographic and video evidence to how this works. And I think other people might feel this way and can back me up here.
You're not alone.
Okay. Jem, do you have anything that you would like to publicly whinge about?
Well, I didn't, but now I have since thought of two things. I'll be very quick. The first thing is Audible purchasing books. Is I don't know if you guys use Audible, but
oh my God, that is a whole
literally the most annoying thing on earth. Like, you can't buy a book in the app. You've got to go look on Amazon and then you buy it and then you go to the app. That's my first complaint. And my second complaint, which I'm sure maybe has even featured on the podcast before, is the little adapter thing for the headphones that, you know, when you get an iPhone X and it's you need to get the little adapter. And I've left like
the plane
almost for this podcast today. I had to go and find old headphones, put in my computer, and that little white bit,
I always have my little white bit, but now I can't charge my phone and listen to my headphones at the same time.
Yes,
to me, the worst thing in the world. They're destroying everyone's lives.
Obviously not respecting the brave decision that Apple took to remove the headphone jack, but another day. Jem, where can people find more about you online?
Well, of course, Instagram, MrsEves101, or JemO'Brien.com, or...
Mrs. Eves 100. What was the 101 about?
Well, when I started my Instagram account, Mrs. Eves, obviously a font, but I think it was taken probably by a true Mrs. Eves. And so I became 101.
A friend of mine has like Mrs._Eves.
we should talk offline about this.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Gemma. We will talk very soon. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, B.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Norm. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We're also now on Stitcher and Spotify as well, if that is your thing. To receive all the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little email, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter, as well as archives of our shows and show notes can be found at JackieWinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating us, and commenting on iTunes. Details on our website at JackieWinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Been a bit rusty, Jem. Been away for about like 6 weeks here. So we're just trying to just get back on this bike. Bianca, stop highlighting things.
Oh,
thank you. It's changing. Your cursor's all over my screen.